This episode of The Y-Files is brought to you by Rocket Money. In 1920, a Harvard scientist put rats in a maze with two exits. One path was well-lit but electrified. The other was dark but safe. The rat tried the bright exit. It got shocked. It tried again. It got shocked. Again and again. It took 165 painful tries, but it finally learned to take the dark path. 15 years later and 30 generations later, the rats needed just 20 tries. They were getting smarter. The solution was passed genetically. That's not supposed to happen. A scientist in Scotland tried the same experiment with a completely different set of rats. His rats started at 25 tries, as if they already knew the answer to the puzzle. Knowledge had crossed the ocean, and no one could explain how.
We did it.
Yes, we actually did, didn't we?
Newman, I need $50,000 in your garage.
No.
You didn't even ask what it was for.
What's it for?
I'm making a documentary.
Do you remember what happened the last time you tried to make a documentary?
Those charges got dropped. Anyway, this one's about me. Working title, Moriarty Unbowed. It's a sweeping cinematic portrait of genius, sacrifice, and one fish's relentless pursuit of greatness against impossible odds.
What impossible odds? You have it better than anyone I know.
You're the antagonist. It's nothing personal.
Who's gonna watch this?
Everyone, it's a cultural event. I've already contacted Sundance, Cannes, and a very respected local festival hosted at an Applebee's parking lot every August. So how about that $50,000?
Absolutely not. Why don't you use your own money?
I'm broke.
You literally just got paid, and you make more than me. Where did it all go?
The economy's bad, human. Inflation's up, interest rates are up, and apparently I'm personally funding 67 free trials I forgot to cancel.
Look, why don't you just use Rocket Money? It tracks your spending, it helps you find those monthly bills that you forgot about, and helps you cancel them with just a few clicks.
Oh, did you just turn my cinematic vision into a sponsored segment?
Yep. I'm the type of person who signs up for free trials and forgets to cancel. By the time I notice, I've been paying for something I haven't touched in months. Since signing up with Rocket Money, every subscription draining my account is pulled into one place, so I can actually see where my money's going. And if I want something gone, I cancel it right in the app. Rocket Money also helps you get a real handle on your spending. Set up a budget by category so you know exactly where your money's going each month. And the alerts for large transactions and upcoming bills means nothing catches you off guard. As someone who used to dread checking their finances, having everything in one view has made it a lot less overwhelming. I don't have to log in and hop between different accounts just to get a clear picture. Go to rocketmoney.com/Y-Files to start your free premium trial. You can also scan the QR code or click the link down below.
Rocketmoney.com/Y-Files.
That's right.
Okay, I got it open.
Okay, so how many subscriptions do you have?
I'm gonna need you to stay calm. Filmmaking masterclass I never opened. Screenwriting software I use for the title page. 18 months of artisanal popcorn. And then the one I can't say out loud.
Rocket Money can help you cancel all those with just a few clicks.
So I'll actually have money again?
Significantly more, yes.
Enough for the documentary?
No.
It's a very personal film, human. It must be made.
Oh, how personal are we talking?
Now there's a love scene. I play both parts.
Lamarckism, or Lamarckian inheritance, is the idea that an organism can pass on skills it acquired during its lifetime, like a rat learning to avoid electric shocks, or a human learning how to throw a football. The theory is named for zoologist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, who proposed it in 1809, and the theory is supposed to be wrong. Standard biology says that knowledge can't be inherited. Only traits can. Eye color, intelligence, allergies, but not knowledge, not information. Harvard psychologist William McDougall tested this theory in 1920. The setup was simple: rats and a water maze. He used Worcester rats, common in labs because they're genetically identical, perfect for this experiment. The maze had two ways out. One was brightly lit and easy to find. The other exit was dark. The bright exit delivered an electric shock. The dark exit was safe. And McDougall added a twist. The bright exit moved. Sometimes it was to the left, sometimes to the right. So the rats couldn't memorize a direction. They had to learn one rule: avoid the light.
Cross over, children. Go into the light. There is peace and serenity in the light.
Rats should naturally avoid the dark and swim toward the way out that they can see. Any animal would. You would. That's exactly what happened. McDougall's rats swam toward the bright exit, got shocked, swam back, and tried again, and got shocked again. Sometimes over 300 times. On average, the first generation took 165 tries before they learned dark equals safe, light equals pain. Then McDougall bred the rats and tested their offspring. But he selected parents at random. He wasn't cherry-picking for intelligence. He just grabbed any two rats and put their offspring in the maze to see how they behaved. And according to standard biology, the new generation should start from scratch. They should average 165 tries. That's not what happened. Generation 2 did better, 141 tries on average. Generation 3, 118. By Generation 8, rats were averaging 56 tries. That's when McDougall noticed something strange. The improvement wasn't slowing down, it was accelerating. 8 more generations, the average dropped down to 41. 8 more, down to 29. By Generation 30, rats were solving the maze with just 20 tries. What took their ancestors 165 attempts, they mastered in 20. They were 8 times faster at learning the same task. McDougall tried to break the pattern. He split his colony and started breeding specifically for slow learners, taking the worst performers from each generation and mating them together. These rats should have stayed slow or gotten worse, but they got faster too. Same rate of improvement as the randomly bred line. The slowest learners were producing offspring that learned faster than their parents, generation after generation. McDougall published his results carefully. No wild claims, no revolutionary declarations, just the data. 30 generations, thousands of rats, every trial documented. He mentioned in his private notes that it looked like Lamarck might have been right. Skills could be inherited, but genetics don't work that way. Except here it was, happening in his lab. The rats were inheriting something. Not genes, not training. They were inheriting the ability to solve a puzzle their parents had learned through pain and repetition. Whatever was happening, it wasn't genetics. Because not only were skills being transmitted across generations, they were being transmitted across the entire species all over the world. F.A.E. Crew was a geneticist at Edinburgh, a pioneer in animal genetics. He thought McDougall was sloppy, so in 1923, he set up his own experiment to prove it. He set up the same water maze, same Worcester rats, just different genes. But he also added a control group, something McDougall didn't do. He had a trained line of rats and an untrained line.
Oh yeah, we got a nerd throwdown. In one corner wearing a tweed jacket and horn-rimmed glasses is the shrink William McDougall, a.k.a. the social psycho, a.k.a. Freud Rage. And in the other corner, also wearing a tweed jacket and horn-rimmed glasses, is the geneticist F.A.E. Crew, a.k.a. the phenotype foo, a.k.a. Genes Wilder. Welcome to the fray in the DNA. Let's get ready to rumble!
Crew expected his trained rats to master the maze in about 20 tries, and they did. But the untrained rats should have averaged 165 tries. They averaged 25. 30 generations, that's what it took McDougall's rats to crack the maze. These rats had no genetic connection to any of those, and they just needed 25 tries on day one. W.E. Agar, a scientist at the University of Melbourne, ran a similar study for 20 years. Same result. Trained and untrained, related and unrelated, different labs, different countries, it didn't matter. The knowledge was spreading through the entire species. But it wasn't just rats. For years, milk was left on people's doorsteps, glass bottles with foil caps. And I can't believe I'm old enough to remember this, but I am. In 1920, in Southampton, England, the blue tit birds learned something useful about milk.
Hang on.
Oh, crap.
Did you just say blue tit birds?
Yes. Sometimes they're called blue caps, but technically they're...
Blue.
Can you please stop saying...
Hey, we're going to be talking about blue tits and milk for a while.
We are.
Oh, baby, it's Christmas morning, and Santa's been good to Daddy.
Here's what the birds...
Blue tits.
Here's what they learned about milk. Pierce the foil cap, drink the cream. This behavior spread all over Britain. By the 1940s, they were all doing it. Every...
Go ahead.
Every blue tit was doing it.
Hey, do you have any stories about blue bazoombas or turquoise tatas?
No.
Cobalt cans, periwinkle peaks, midnight melons.
No.
Denim dumplings, sapphire sandbags.
That's enough.
I can't breathe.
You could argue that the birds were watching each other and learning this trick. But then came World War II. All aluminum was needed for aircraft, so no more foil caps. They used wood or cheaper, harder metal. Blue tits couldn't get through. They only live a couple of years, so by the time the war was over, every bird that had ever pierced a cap was dead. The entire generation that knew the trick, they were gone. But when the foil caps came back, blue tits were piercing them again. Birds that had never seen the trick across all of Britain, all at the same time. This wasn't genetics, memory, or observation. This was a skill somehow encoded into the species itself. But this can happen to non-living things too, specifically crystals. When chemists synthesize a new compound, getting it to crystallize for the first time can take months or years. Different temperatures, different solvents, different pressures. The molecules just won't organize. They won't form a pattern until one day they do. And then something strange happens. A compound that resisted crystallization for decades suddenly crystallizes everywhere. On Earth. Glycerol was a liquid for centuries. No one could crystallize it. Then in 1867, a barrel crystallized during shipment to Vienna. After that, glycerol crystallized easily everywhere. Xylitol, same story. Decades of failure, then one success, then success everywhere. Rats, birds, crystals. They were passing behaviors to each other all over the world. Something had to be carrying this information, something we couldn't see, something we didn't understand. But in 1981, a young scientist from Cambridge found a pattern. Not only could species pass information anywhere around the world, they could pass information anywhere through time. In 1973, Rupert Sheldrake sat in his Cambridge lab staring at a bean plant. It was doing something that shouldn't be possible, according to everything he knew about biochemistry.
Hang on. The guy was called Rupert Sheldrake.
Yes, why?
That's the kind of name that's going to cost you a fortune in lunch money.
Yeah, I don't think there was a lot of bullying going on at Cambridge.
Oh, wake up, human. Wedgies are universal. I bet even Stephen Hawking had to eat his own tighty-whities from time to time. And he sat on those things all day.
Anyway, bean plants are like vines. They can't stand on their own. They need a structure to grow around. A wall, a fence, a tree. He was growing plants using pots, and small wooden poles for support. Same method every time. The plant sprouts, grows toward the pole, and starts climbing. But this particular bean plant was doing something very strange. It was growing toward a pole that wasn't there yet. It was growing to where the pole would be in the future. Now, Sheldrake was a serious scientist. Cambridge Fellowship, Harvard, PhD in biochemistry, director of studies at age 31. His research on plant hormones is still in textbooks today. But this bean plant was bothering him. Plants don't have eyes. They don't have nervous systems. The support pole wouldn't be installed for another 2 days, yet the bean was already changing its growth pattern, already preparing to climb something that didn't exist yet. He'd seen this before, thousands of times. Every biologist had. They just didn't talk about it. DNA doesn't actually contain the blueprint for what an organism becomes. An acorn has the same DNA in every cell, but those cells grow into roots or leaves, branches. They organize themselves into a tree, and nobody can really explain how they know to do that. Think of DNA like Lego bricks. A Star Wars set and a castle set use exactly the same pieces. The only difference is the final shape. A fruit fly, a banana, even a human being share most of the same DNA, but they develop into completely different organisms. The final shape isn't in the DNA. Something else is guiding the process. One night, walking home along the River Cam, Sheldrake had a moment of clarity. Maybe nature has a memory. When any system organizes itself, a crystal forming, a plant growing, an animal learning, it creates what Sheldrake would call a morphic field, a memory in nature. A similar system can resonate with that field and access that memory, meaning a bird learning to pierce the foil, crystals learning to form. And the more that memory is accessed, the stronger it gets. And it influences everything that comes after, across space and time. No physical connection required, because that memory is now part of nature, all of nature, everywhere, forever. In 1974, Sheldrake moved to India to work at an agricultural institute. That was his day job. He spent his nights at a monastery, and for 18 months, between prayers and meditation, he wrote a book proposing that the universe has memory. He called it A New Science of Life. He published it in 1981. The most important science journal in the world responded by calling for his book to be burned. The theory of morphic resonance cost Sheldrake his career, and a few years later, it almost cost him his life. September 1981, John Maddox, editor of Nature, then the most prestigious science journal in the world, wrote an editorial about Sheldrake's book. He called it the best candidate for burning there's been for many years. Nature publishes Nobel laureates, Einstein, Watson and Crick, Darwin. Calling for book burning was unprecedented in modern history of the journal. Maddox compared the book to Hitler's Mein Kampf and its potential for damage. He wasn't calling Sheldrake wrong, he was calling him dangerous. Maddox even said, Sheldrake's not a real scientific theorist. It's not even a theory. It's an exercise in pseudoscience.
You see, Sheldrake's is not a scientific theory. Sheldrake is putting forward magic instead of science. And that can be condemned, but in exactly the language that the popes used to condemn Galileo. And for the same reasons, it is heresy.
Professors curious about morphic resonance went silent. Graduate students were warned away. Research funding dried up. But the more the establishment attacked Sheldrake, the more people read his work. The book-burning editorial made Sheldrake's book a bestseller. He became the most talked-about biologist in Britain overnight. Not for science, but for the attempt to suppress it. But the worst attack on Sheldrake wasn't intellectual. April 2, 2008, he was giving a lecture in Santa Fe. A man in the audience rushed the stage with a knife. He stabbed Sheldrake in the leg, then security tackled him. The attacker told police and a reporter afterward that Sheldrake was using him as a subject in telepathic mind control experiments for 5 years. The wound was serious, but Sheldrake recovered, and days later, still using a walker, he gave a talk titled Science and Hope. In March 2013, Sheldrake gave a TEDx talk called The Science Delusion. He challenged what he called the 10 dogmas of modern science, that nature is mechanical, that matter is unconscious, and that mind is nothing but brain activity, that kind of stuff. Well, TED removed the talk from their YouTube channel. Bloggers campaigned against it. TED consulted what they called a science board, but they never told us who was on it. The talk was about scientific dogmatism. The response was dogmatic censorship. But the attempts to silence Sheldrake kept backfiring. The banned TED talk got millions of views on other channels. The stabbing made international news. Every attack made more people ask, what are they so afraid of? Then a British TV broadcaster had an idea. They would test morphic resonance on the largest scale ever attempted. So now there were 2 million people about to test this theory on live TV. In 1984, British television ran an experiment. They showed viewers a puzzle, one of those hidden pictures where you stare at random dots until an image appears. About 2 million people watched. Then researchers tested people who hadn't seen the broadcast. Some were in different cities, some were in different countries. They solved that specific puzzle faster than a control group tested before the broadcast. And not a little faster, much faster. Those 2 million people who watched the show gave nature a new memory, a solution to that puzzle. Sheldrake said this could apply to crossword puzzles. He said crosswords should get easier to solve as the day goes on. As more and more people solve the puzzle, they're creating and reinforcing a morphic memory. That new memory makes the puzzle easier for everyone trying the puzzle for the first time.
Oh, maybe that's why I'm so naturally great with women, huh?
I don't even know.
Moriarty men historically put up numbers that would make Wilt Chamberlain jealous.
Okay, gross. Thanks. Great interjection. Some newspapers tested the puzzle theory. The London Evening Standard found their puzzles were solved 20% faster in the evening after thousands of people spent the day solving them. Then there's the Flynn effect. Since the 1920s, IQ scores have risen worldwide by about 3 points per decade. Every generation scores higher than the last on the exact same tests. Experts credit better nutrition, better education, better test-taking skills, but the gains show up even in pattern recognition tests that don't rely on education at all. Morphic resonance says as more humans master cognitive tasks, those tasks become easier for everyone. Sheldrake's most famous research involves dogs. He documented over 200 cases of dogs that go to the door or window when their owners decide to come home. Not when they come home, when they decide to. Owners came home at random times, in unfamiliar vehicles. The dogs still knew. One dog, a terrier named JT, was tested over 100 times. Within 10 seconds of his owner leaving work, JT went to the window 85% of the time. The owner was 4 miles away. Then there's the sense of being stared at. Sheldrake ran 25,000 trials. Subjects guessed whether someone was looking at them from behind. They guessed right 55% of the time. Should be 50%. Now, 5% might not seem like much, but with that huge sample size, it's significant. We've all had that feeling where we know someone's looking at us. The book Lifetide, released in 1979, is about monkeys on Kushima Island. One learned to wash sweet potatoes in the ocean. Other monkeys copied her. Once 100 monkeys learned the trick, monkeys on other islands started washing potatoes too. Just like McDougal's rats, knowledge had jumped across the ocean. We've got rats and monkeys teaching each other on different islands, dogs and plants that can predict the future, people solving puzzles faster as the day goes on.
I just like blue tits and milk.
Okay.
Hey, didn't Luke Skywalker drink that stuff in The Last Jedi?
I don't know what you're talking about. I never heard of that movie.
Fair enough.
I love the concept of morphic resonance, but is it true? Well, let's start with the bad news. That famous monkey story, that's completely made up. Bly Watson took real observations from primatologists and added a little fiction for fun. The crystal formations have a conventional explanation too. When scientists first synthesize a new compound, it resists crystallization. After one lab succeeds, others find it easier. Sheldrake says it's morphic fields. Chemists say it's seed crystals. Microscopic traces on clothing, in beards, on shared equipment that's shipped between labs. And once the crystals exist anywhere, they exist everywhere. No mysterious fields required. That one is a stretch for me, but that's the official scientific view. Now, the crossword puzzles and TV experiments are interesting, but the effects are small and the methods are contested. So they can go either way. It's not the smoking gun that Sheldrake needs. But then there are the rats. McDougal's data is real. Crew replicated it. Agar replicated it on a separate continent. Rats got smarter across generations with no physical contact. Now, critics explain it like this. Early generations of rats were stressed by inexperienced researchers who didn't handle them properly. So as the researchers got better at handling them, the rats did better on the test. Now, I think the skeptics lose that one, especially when we consider something discovered decades after McDougal died, epigenetics. This shows acquired traits can chemically tag DNA and pass information to offspring. So the effect might be real. The cause, we still don't know. The dogs anticipating their owners coming home is Sheldrake's strongest published work. Critics have found methodological problems, but defenders have replicated the results. That one is still being debated, and every dog owner has thoughts. Now here's the core problem that skeptics use. Morphic resonance requires information transfer with no energy cost, and that violates the law of conservation of energy. Physics has rules, but not all physics, not quantum physics. Two particles separated by any distance, a room, a galaxy, it doesn't matter. They respond to each other instantly. This was confirmed in the 1980s. That's an instant transfer of information that ignores the law of conservation of energy and ignores the speed of light. And nobody knows how this works. In the 1930s, Carl Jung proposed a collective unconscious, a shared reservoir of human experience running beneath individual awareness. Physicist David Bohm said all points in space are fundamentally connected. Erwin Schrödinger, one of the architects of quantum mechanics and famous for the cat, argued that individual consciousness is just an illusion, that there's only one mind. Max Planck, Nikola Tesla, Albert Einstein all arrived at the same place from completely different directions. Some through mathematics, some through watching rats learn mazes, some through quantum theory itself. All of them looked at the universe and landed on the same word, connected. Maybe the laws of nature are fixed, written into the fabric of reality before the first star formed. Or maybe the universe creates memories that strengthen through repetition, always evolving. We can't prove it either way. But there is one scientific fact that nobody can deny. A long time ago, every atom in your body was connected to every other atom and every other person on Earth. Every atom in your body was connected to every atom in every animal, every plant, every rock, and every planet in the universe. And if the smallest things in existence stay connected to each other across any distance, then acting like the people around you are separate from you isn't just unkind, it's unscientific. Thank you so much for hanging out today. My name is AJ, that's Hecklefish. This has been The Y-Files. If you had fun or learned anything, he'd appreciate it if you hit like, subscribe, comment, share. That stuff really helps us out. And like most topics we cover on the channel, today's was recommended by you. And if there's a story you'd like to see or learn more about, go to theyfiles.com/tips. Hop on Discord, email us, send a chat. There's a lot of ways to get a hold of us. We're always looking for topic ideas. And remember, The Y-Files is also a podcast. You can take us on the road. You get to hear the same videos we play here, plus there's some bonus content, like the stuff that's really not allowed here. It's called The Y-Files Operation Podcast, and it's available everywhere. And if you are listening on an audio platform right now, do me a favor and hit the buttons, the follow, the like, the thumbs up, the good ratings, the star, all that stuff. That really makes a big, big difference. I'd appreciate it. Now, if you need more Y-Files in your life, I'd suggest... You stepped on my joke, buddy. If you need more Y-Files in your life, check out our Discord. You know how many people are on there? We're wrapping it up. I'm leaving it in. There are about 100,000 members on Discord now, so 24/7, there's someone on there hanging out, talking about the same weird stuff we do here. It's a great community, it's a lot of fun, and it's free to join. And speaking of 24/7, make sure you... He's just flopping around like a fish on the deck of a boat. You good, buddy? Yeah. Check out our 24/7 stream on the Y-Files backstage. There's a link down below. Over there, we run episodes back-to-back with some fun content in between. And the live chat, it's hilarious. The people over there have created an incredible community. If you enjoy the stories I tell on the Y-Files, check out my other show on the channel called The Basement. It's a conversation show where I chat with the interesting people behind the episodes. Experts on fun topics like the Knights Templar, time travel, moon landing hoax, JFK, UFO technology, quantum consciousness, all kinds of random stuff. And if there's someone you'd like to see on the show, let me know. I'm always looking for good guests. A special thanks to our patrons who made this channel possible. Every episode of The Y-Files is dedicated to my Patreon members. I couldn't do any of this without your support. And if you'd like to keep us going, support the channel, join this crazy community, become a member on Patreon. For as little as $3 a month, you get access to perks like seeing videos early with no commercials, exclusive merch, and at least 2 private live streams every week, all just for you. And the whole Y-Files team is on the stream, not just me. So you get to see Gino, Victoria, Mary Jane, Hybrid, Jen, whoever I'm forgetting. You get to meet everybody. All our cameras are on, but also you can turn on your camera. Hop up on stage, ask a question, tell a joke, talk about anything you want. It's a great way to get to know us as people. I think it's the best perk there is. Another great way to support the channel is grab something from the Y-Files store.
Yeah, grab a heck of a t-shirt. One of these chisel coffee mugs you can stick your fist in. Or one of your blue tits in there. Whatever you want. Whatever you want to put in. Yeah, put it in. Oh, I can't. Get honey. I show my face. Squeezy. Animal. Okay, I can't do it.
But if you're going to buy merch, make sure you become a member on YouTube. Hear me out. YouTube members get 10% off everything in the Y-Files store. So if you're going to spend $40 on t-shirts or fistable coffee mugs, if you know, you know. If you're going to spend $40 over there, join on YouTube, get the code, it pays for itself, and then just cancel if you want. The code is there to save you money, not make me money. In fact, all that revenue goes to the team. I don't touch it. So thank you for that.
Yeah, keep that secret close to your blue tits, would you?
Those are the plugs, and that's going to do it. Until next time, be safe, be kind, and know that you are appreciated.
In Area 51, a secret code inside the Bible said I was. I love my UFOs and paranormal fun, as well as music, so I'm singing like I should. But then another conspiracy theory becomes the truth, my friends, and it never ends. No, it never ends. Got it, I got
got stuck inside Mel's home with MK Ultra. I've been only too aware. Did Stanley Kubrick fake the moon landing alone on a film set, or were the shadow people there? The Roswell aliens just fought the smiling man, I'm told, and his name was Cold. And I can't believe I'm dancing with the fishes. Heck of fish on Thursday nights with AJ2 and the the solar storm still come to a Agatha, the secret city underground. Mysterious number stations, planet Serpo 2, Project Stargate, and what the Dark Watchers found. In a simulation, don't you worry though, the Black Knight satellite, it's over.